Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're also at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking to the young people from the teen comedy troupe here in Santa Fe, and we will be speaking with peace activist George Paz Martin. Right now, I would like to welcome Jan Adelman. He is an artist and a former museum director, curator, lecturer, writer, and his exhibition, Jan Adelman, Latter-day Fabergé, Assemblages, New and Retrospective, opens this coming Friday at the 8 Modern Gallery on Delgado Street here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So you grew up in Maine, mm-hmm. in the same town as the great artist Louise Nevelson.
That's for sure, yeah.
Did you know her?
Yes, and I mean, good that you cite her immediately. It was a very small town of 5,000, a little fishing village, Rockland, Maine. She was from there, but she rarely ever returned. But when she returned, I always met her because my mother and she had been classmates in high school in the little town of Rockland, Maine, and they lived in the same street. And so from my earliest experiences, her brother owned a hotel in Rockland, Maine, and in the lobby he had installed a number of her major assemblage pieces that any museum would give its eye teeth for. And most of the people in the town would bring in visiting friends to laugh. To laugh out loud at how crazy this art was. Just call it art, you know. And the thing is from my very earliest experience, I was fascinated by it, and I also understood, but didn't realize it for many decades later, that I understood from the get-go, this is art, but it's made from junk. It's from found materials. She painted it all black or gold or white. And I think the main reason she did that was in order that people would not identify the component parts, but would get the whole gestalt immediately, and it would be mysterious and strange. And so in any case, every time she came to my mother, who worked in the hotel where the works were displayed, would say, Louise is coming to town, get all your best drawings together, and wash behind your ears, and come in.
Did anyone ever really say wash behind your ears?
Of course. We're talking the 40s.
Okay.
1940s.
And so you would get your drawings out and...
And then Louise would go through them and say how talented you are and blah, blah, blah. You know, and she was very strange and quite an apparition. So, from a very tender age in a very conventional little conservative town on the coast of Maine, there were these periodic apparitions that later in life I realized, oh, wow, she's the one who made it early on clear to me that this is perfectly acceptable to make art out of junk.
Now, assemblage, what would you say? Is that like the 3D version of collage?
Collage, totally, yes, exactly. And it only really begins in with Picasso and then Duchamp and people like that who start taking things from the everyday world and either presenting them exactly as they are, famously Duchamp's scandalous sculpture that was a urinal upside down on a pedestal.
Right.
Or they would put materials together, and by putting the materials together, they become something different than what they were when they were just pieces of something, and they have a whole new life.
It's interesting that you say that people are meant to see the whole gestalt when all these pieces are put together. I suppose they're also meant to see the individual pieces on some level, because otherwise they would just sculpt from an uncarved block.
Yes, that's true. I always have mixed emotions about it because I'm hoping that people respond first and foremost to the gestalt, the overall thing that had never existed before. Then it's perfectly fine with me if you want to deconstruct. Oh, well, that's a bicycle seat. Oh, well, that looks like that's a nut or a bolt or a screw. Oh, well, that is an old syringe, as there is a piece in this show.
And a very strange and unusual syringe, I must say.
To say the really well, I call it diamond studded. Yeah, so it does change the object.
And it's
totally.
And it's metal and has little graspy things on
yes,
it.
Yes, right. So you have a good grip when it was being used. But it's very old. It's probably 60, 70 years old.
So where do you get the materials from which you make your assemblage?
The universe is frankly, what is fair play for someone who works in assemblage. And I like the colors. And I like color. So, I would never do what Nevelson did, which was to choose to paint everything red or white or black. Because I love the color and I love the play of colors and textures and materials and so on. So I don't do that. But I get a lot of my material from a place at Los Alamos, which many artists gratefully recognize as a resource, called the Black Hole. And I even give docent tours there on occasion for friends who've never been and they want to know, what is this place you go to? So it's cast off materials, not radioactive, from Los Alamos National Laboratory.
Certified, not radioactive.
Well, I'm still here, and I've been gathering materials there for decades, so I guess it's fine, you know.
Are there still new materials coming in there all the time?
Sure, because the lab is, it's growing. It isn't static, and, they divest the materials. I use anything from rubber, ceramic, laboratory glass, precision steel, and then things that I have no idea what they're made of or what they ever... Most of the time, I never know what their original function was. I do know that taxpayers probably paid a fortune for a lot of this stuff that is now cast off.
Yeah, the proverbial $800 hammer.
Yes, totally. And, I use a lot of precision steel that I find there. And precision steel is practically as expensive as, a gold brooch or a diamond ring, but at the Black Hole, it winds up being, give me $20.
Right.
Whereas the taxpayer probably paid, $1,000 for 10.
And so now this is being recycled into artwork. As I was looking at your work earlier, I was thinking about or wondering if there was a kind of New Mexico nuclear aesthetic that has made, because so many people are using materials from the Black Hole.
Well, I suppose if someone really wanted to curate, God knows I wouldn't mind doing that. You could probably put together an exhibition of artists who've used materials from the Black Hole. Certainly an artist took me there years ago. I forget her name, but she was I'll never forget her bringing me there because it made a big difference. But that was like a decade ago. I think, it's fair game. I also find materials at the Five and Dime. I find them at Goodwill, junk stores anywhere, on the roadside. You can't tell where some... And I gather materials, and I may sit on them for years until finally, I need a piece that's made of something that has this color or will fit here. And one piece in there, I won't tell you which, but one of those in there was made in an hour. Others have taken several years to come together.
And so some of them are hanging on the wall, some of them are sitting on a table or on a type of pedestal, and of course the Black Hole probably is great for gear-shaped or round-shaped things that make excellent pedestals.
They totally do, and then other things make, I have found some other things that make nice pedestals too, and basically those things that the things that stand on a table or a pedestal, I always refer to them as what the French used to call surprise de table. They're table surprises. They're not meant to do a thing. They just are what they are, and they're there to surprise when you sit down at the dinner table.
So this is an exhibition of assemblages. We're talking to Jan Adelman, whose work is opening this Friday at the 8 Modern Gallery here in Santa Fe. It says new and retrospective. So you've made some new work from this for mm-hmm. this show, and then mm-hmm. other work you've actually borrowed from people who've already
acquired.
Collected it.
Yes, because they asked me if I would like to guest curate an exhibition for them, 8 Modern. And I said, that would be a nice idea, but let me come back to you. Eventually I came back and I said, how about I wear two hats? As a museum curator and director of decades, how about I curate an exhibition, selections from Santa Fe collections of my work.
Can you curate your own work?
Of course
work?
You can. You could write your own biography. You can curate your own work.
I guess.
Yeah. Autobiography, auto-curate.
Are you objective?
Yes, I am objective because there are many more works in Santa Fe collections than I selected.
Right.
And some of them I selected out of affection, for the piece or for the person or for both. Others I selected because they're magnum opus. I mean, that one took a lot of work, and there's a lot of great material in it. So it's all very personal, a personal curation of 6 years' work. I've had two prior solo exhibitions in Santa Fe at Llewellyn Gallery and Fred Klein. So, and then I said, and then I'll flank it. I'll wear, put on another hat as artist, which is a relatively new hat, only since the 90s for me. Make 12 new works so that you have something to sell.
So you've really spent your life as an art historian, a curator, a museum director, a writer, a critic. Do you have, as an artist, the weight of history and criticism on your shoulders when you make this stuff?
To say the least, yeah. And the thing is that for years, I mean, I was very, very busy, and so there was very little downtime when you could try to draw or maybe even try to paint. And almost invariably, when I had that downtime and when I tried to draw or on holiday or to paint, I would get halfway through, or I might even finish the thing, and I would sit back and I'd say, Matisse did it better. You know, Picasso did it better. And throw it away or give it away. Because of the weight of history and the fact that I have been visiting art and design museums for the last more than five decades. You know, I mean, I'm saturated. Because I like decorative art as well as fine art, you know, porcelain, glass, china, jewelry, Fabergé, you know, that sort of stuff. So I suddenly stumbled on assemblage as something I didn't feel bad about, I didn't feel awkward about or apologetic about, whereas I would never show anybody my drawings or my paintings, you know?
It's a shame,
and
isn't
then
it?
I realized that Nevelson must have done that to me, and I never realized it.
Oh, interesting.
You know, I just out of the I mean, I've always liked assemblage and collage. But then when I decided I wanted to make those some stuff, things like that, as I gradually did it, I thought, oh, this is Louise's influence. And I was a child, you know, but I was, quote, what they used to call an artistic child, you know. My mother said, bring your drawings.
Well, there is something, I think, and I'm sure it has to do with human psychology and brain development, things like that, but things that you did as a child run very deep, and there's a comfort in doing them that you don't necessarily have with things that you learned later.
Yeah, very true. I mean, one of the elements that I love in Louise Nevelson's work is the fact that when she would come to my hometown, she was always on the lookout for wood, of course, cast-off wood, because her things were all made of wood, found wood. But what she loved to get was, if she could, gingerbread off old Victorian houses. Because now that is really spectacular found material. And once it's painted black, it becomes like strange lace against shards of other things and maybe an old toilet seat. Once again, you know, I'd stand there next to someone and they'd say, I think that's a toilet seat. And I'd say, well, it might have been, but we have to think differently now.
Well, and that's an interesting thing. As before we went on the show, you were saying that people who aren't used to looking at abstract art feel a kind of need to grasp onto the thing that they do recognize, which is a natural reaction.
It's their entry point, absolutely, sure. Then they can stand back from it and say, but, well, you know, it is what it is. I mean, someone famously said, a poem must not mean, but be. It is what it is, altogether. But yes, it has component parts, yeah.
And so your exhibition is called Latter-day Fabergé. Explain to us that title.
Well, because there's one piece in there called Fearsome Fabergé, and that's the piece that involves an old hypodermic syringe that has been encrusted with faux diamonds. But I've always admired Fabergé as one of the great craftsmen and companies who made extraordinary useless objects, like the famous Easter eggs, effectively a useless bauble of immense artisanship.
For czars to feel good about themselves.
Right, exactly. You know. And so when we were casting about for a title, prior shows I've had have been also had provocative titles. Who's Your Dada was one, and then the other one was Underwear for the Deaf. So I wanted to keep up that tradition of, how's that again?
Right. And so these pieces, I mean, it's interesting that some of them you take years to make, some of them you make in a much shorter time. How important is the craft in your piece versus the concept?
Oh, I think, well, I would be the first to say that I think the concept is everything, and I've learned my craft by the seat of my pants, because I'm constantly combining materials that don't necessarily stick well together.
Ah.
Rubber on ceramic, on glass, on plastic, on precision steel. How in heaven's name do you join these together that they don't fall apart?
So you've had to learn a great deal about adhesives.
Adhesives. And I have to go to Albuquerque to buy my adhesives, and they come in insanely expensive tubes. And if, God forbid, your fingers stay together 2 seconds because you have to go to the hospital. And even then, you know, I'll have technical problems. But so did Cellini, so did Michelangelo, you know, with their materials, you know.
Right, right. We're talking to Jan Adelman. Tell us about some of the inspirations for your work. And I would imagine that they came through your whole life's work.
Yes, they do. They've come primarily through, yes, necessarily being an art museum director and then visiting museums, both art and design, all my life, more than 50 years, well, from my childhood, really. And it all is milling around in your head. And when I had to write an artist statement for my first exhibition in 2003, I named a couple of examples of things that sound ostensibly very far apart from one another, but they are all swirling around in my head when I am creating my contraptions, my objet. And one of them was this man named Rube Goldberg.
Right, right.
This is a drawing of a famous Rube Goldberg invention. It is soup and the napkin that comes after, and it's all about how if he takes the soup spoon up, it trips a lever, which makes a parrot squawk, which makes an alarm clock goes off, which trips a lever, which raises something else to bring the napkin to his mouth after the sip of soup. What it is a Rube Goldberg invention means something that is so unlikely, all thrown together.
Was Rube Goldberg a real person?
Oh, totally.
And
I mean, you have to be a certain age, I think, to know that.
No, I know. I mean, sometimes, I mean, even working at a radio station, certain things become sort of Rube
Goldbergian. Oh, yes, yeah. Luckily, he's going to be famous forever.
Right, but these very funny and clever kind of weird domino effect inventions and contraptions, they were just works of art to make people laugh, I assume.
Yes, they were. He was a comic strip artist, but, I mean, his shtick was to create these incredibly elaborate contraptions that all had to work to work. And this one, it starts out with lifting a spoon of soup to your mouth, and after going through many transmogrifications, winds up lifting a serviette, you know, a napkin to your lips after the soup.
Right.
And I think of my things as put together in very much the same fashion. They're Rube Goldberg. They don't have any real function, you know.
Neither does that. He's handing me a piece of paper, which is a Duchamp artwork, which is a stool with an upside-down bicycle wheel stuck into the center of the stool.
Yes, from 1913, right. Now, see, now that he put two things together that, like his famous urinal and like many another piece of the early 20th century, totally upset the apple cart in the history of what constitutes fine art. I mean, it's one of the very first mobiles, because you can turn the wheel and it'll move.
That's right.
I mean, it's the total gestalt is more than the individual parts in it. You know?
So the two things that you've talked about so far, the Rube Goldberg and the Duchamp, it's kind of, you might call, I mean, I don't even believe in these things, and I think they were kind of passe, but low art and high arts, so-called, things that are outside the academy and things that are in. How do you see that at this point in history?
Oh, I think that it's a crapshoot in this point in history. I mean, in the history of modern art. After all, we're well into the 21st century now, and anything goes, and assemblage has been around more than 100 years now. Famously, the Museum of Modern Art did an exhibition about 20 years ago, 25 years ago, called High and Low, which was all about 20th century artists reaching into the domain of the everyday and pulling their materials from the everyday and elevating it to the status of high art. Comic strips become Roy Lichtenstein and Andy Warhol and so on, and but also found objects become like this piece by Merritt Oppenheim.
And ladies and gentlemen, I'm holding up to the microphone a teacup, a spoon, and a saucer that are all completely covered with fur.
Mm-hmm. And that's by a Swiss woman artist named Merritt Oppenheim. Another great inspiration for me. I mean, it is utterly, obviously not functional. In fact, makes you recoil. And that's
if
another...
If you imagine drinking your tea out of it anyway.
Of a fur-lined cup, yeah. And the thing is, that's one of the elements in my work that occasionally arises, that I mean, I like the idea of making someone recoil. For example, with the diamond-studded hypodermic.
Right.
It's not every...
That didn't make me recoil. I thought it was pretty.
Well, then you've I've won you over.
I mean, because it's sitting on a kind of, I don't know if it's a satin pillow, but I can't remember, but a
strange kind of cushion.
A little cushion.
Comes from Los Alamos Laboratories. I don't know what it was original function.
So it looks almost like one of those pieces of jewelry in a little beautiful
presentation case.
To make it look like a nice present.
Yes, right.
Well, you've been doing this for many, many years, studying, as you say, what, 50 years, looking at art.
Yeah.
And I think, I mean, one of the things that has certainly changed in the 20th century is the importance that people give to art in the larger society. I mean, at the extreme, you have people getting furious about Stravinsky, and we talked about that the other day when there was the Stravinsky ballet program at the Lenzik and so on, or people seeing abstract art or seeing Marcel Duchamp and getting livid and stomping out and big editorials. And somehow that time is gone.
Yeah.
Nobody gets too terribly excited about things, except for every once in a while.
Yes.
Like in the 1980s when Robert Mapplethorpe did certain...
Yes.
But, I mean, how has, in your view, the way that people look at art changed in your lifetime?
Well, I think this... I hope it's all about the enhancement of, let's say, just in the United States, of our education, that people have more opportunities in school and in their education altogether to have exposure to art. I mean, I have in my lifetime, as an art museum director, witnessed the phenomenon of children's programs in art museums. Nowadays, people think nothing of it to be, you know, absolutely, to be swarmed by children in an art museum. If you aren't, you're amazed.
And in fact, you can't get a grant if there's not a children's program component to it.
Absolutely. And I mean, and sometimes they'll go to extremes to find a children's component in order to be able to get some money to pay the electric bill. I mean, this is the art museum director's
hat. It's true. I know.
But art education in America has grown by leaps and bounds in the 20th century. From not having had any education programs in art museums to all art museums having art education programs, to not having any gift shops in art museums to all art museums having gift shops. Indeed, the gift shop comes first. You can't even get into the museum until you've traversed the shop.
Right.
So that's, I'm getting off the shtick of museum directorship. But I mean, I do think that, yes, you know, young people today from all strata are exposed to art and art experiences far beyond what we were when I was a child in the 40s and 50s.
So
that's
the
part of it.
Yeah, so it's interesting. So in a way, that sense of art belonging to a certain educational elite just is no longer the case.
It's really no longer the case, although you will still see occasions wherein you'll encounter occasions where people are deeply offended by a work of art. Usually non-objective, abstract, because they have not had any background in order to be able, have no point of reference in order to be able to look at the work. For example, the piece Fearsome Fabergé, the old syringe that's then studded with diamonds, and suddenly, you would never use a syringe like that for any medical procedure. And some people will just stumble on the syringe and never get past the total gestalt, which is a thing of mystery, a provocation or whatever.
Well, for example, does a piece like that have a symbolic meaning for you?
Not really. No, no, it has no symbolic meaning. It's the Gestalt, you know.
So it's really
a poem must not mean, but be. You see, I mean, it just is and never was before. That's the exciting thing.
True modernism.
Oh yeah, that's right. I mean, it never was before. Now it is.
Right.
And once you've seen it, you'll never forget it. Ideally, a fur-lined teacup you will never forget.
Now there are other works of art that offend people. I mean, I've been highly distressed and disgusted by certain works of art, not coming from a naive place, but coming from a either moral or aesthetic or cultural place. I mean, we have that too, which is a good thing.
Yeah, sure. Oh, yeah, there's no question. I mean, you mentioned Mapplethorpe. God knows there was a great deal of flap over Mapplethorpe. I don't want to get into the pros and cons of his entire work, like life's output, but he certainly was talented. But on the other hand, he certainly was edgy. But on the other hand, why would we deny to art the edginess that we encounter every day in the aisles at Albertsons, on the street, on television? I mean, there's not. It's far edgier what Tiger Woods is involved with right now than anything anyone's painting. I mean, you know, I mean, how can people be scandalized by a work of art when scandalous behavior is on television incessantly?
Right.
All these reality shows, the Octomom, etc. I mean, why aren't people scandalized by that?
Well, and I think, for example, staying with Mapplethorpe, part of that whole set of questions that was raised was the, basically, is it okay to be a gay man and be upfront about it?
Yeah.
And
well, and even more.
And aestheticize the male body as a man.
True, but I mean, he took it even further because he was a gay man involved in sadomasochistic behavior, and that's what he represented. And I mean, there are photographs that would make make anyone recoil. But I mean, he insists, like every modern artist, that all of human experience is worthy of contemplation, and that's where he came from. But you don't have to go see the show. One doesn't have, and if they put signs at the entrance of the exhibition, some may find this, you know, offensive. That means turn around and leave.
Now what?
Don't go in and get offended.
Right now, here's a question for you as a person who's traveled widely.
Yeah.
What kind of differences do you see between Europe and the United States in terms of people accepting or not accepting, getting offended or not getting offended when they go into galleries and museums?
I think that's practically doesn't exist anymore. I mean, the level of sophistication or the level of acceptance of people who go to any kind of art experience in Europe or the United States anymore is pretty much on an even playing field. I do remember, certainly, the first time I went to Pompeii, that only men were allowed to follow the guide into certain rooms where they would pull aside a curtain of a fresco that showed a sexual act. Well, Pompeii is rife with those frescoes of sexual acts. It was a porn city, port town. And so nowadays, those are all visible to anyone, women, children, giraffes. You know, anyone can see this material. We've come a long way.
Right. In a relatively
short
time.
Short time, yeah, yeah.
So, what do you do now? Do you pretty much get to stay home and make your art as much as you want?
Yeah, but it comes in spurts. I mean, I'll always be acquiring material. I'll see something and I'll say, I'd use that sometime. And I just take it home and put it in my studio, which is an old curiosity shop. Really an extension of the old curiosity shop I laughingly call my home, which is jammed with stuff that I've found over the years. I'm a picker. I love to go to junk stores, consignment places, and the black hole, everything. So in any case, I'll work in spurts. I may not do any, and then suddenly I will go for a month, and I'll make a whole body of work. But I'm also writing. I write to off and on reviews for Art in America magazine on local shows in Santa Fe, or I write feature articles for American art journals. And I have been lecturing on luxury trips, actually. They are fine and art and architecture trips overseas for a decade or so. For the National Trust for Historic Preservation, their members on cruises on the Rhine or barging through France or...
Nice work if you
can get
it.
Sailing the Aegean, yes, right. And I get paid.
Excellent. Jan Adelman is an artist, and his show is called Latter-day Fabergé, Assemblages New and Retrospective. It opens this coming Friday, December 11th, at 5:30, from 5:30 to 7:30, at the 8 Modern Gallery at 231 Delgado Street. They can be found at 8modern.net. Jan Adelman, thank you so much for being with us.
I thank you very much.